the apologies of the chair of the CAT, Professor Shabani Manganya, who unfortunately is not able to be here today. My name is Rolf Stump. I'm the interim CEO of the CAT, and with me I have the Chief Financial Officer, Dr. Jan Birkus, and we will briefly take you through the mission-related activities of the CHE, and then Dr. Birkus will take you briefly through the budget and HR issues, and then we'll be open for any questions and interaction after that. On the governance side, the term of office of the present CHE will run out towards the middle of this year, and the minister will follow due process in terms of calling for nominations and putting together a new council on higher education. We have embarked on a process for appointing a new CEO. We did so last year, and unfortunately the candidate identified turned down the offer, and earlier this year the CHE Council then embarked on a subsequent follow-up process, and I'm very pleased to announce that as an outcome of that process, Mr. Ahmed Esop, who was formerly a chief director in the Department of, then the Department of Education, has been appointed as the CEO of the CHE, and he will assume office on the 1st of May 2010. We also appointed a director for accreditation, Dr. Denise Webstock, former head of quality assurance at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, and advertised the position of director standard setting, and the new incoming CEO and I are in discussion around the filling of that post. We've received a good number of applications from that. So from the point of view of the strategic leadership positions in the CHE, all seems to be under control and going forward well, and then the new CHE will have to be constituted sometime in the second half of the year. Our monitoring function is a very important and crucial function for the CHE and involves monitoring, if you like, the health, the temperature, the pulse rate, the heartbeat of our higher education system. And as part of that, we late last year produced this document called The State of Higher Education in South Africa, October 2009. We have some copies here for any members who would like to have them after the presentation. We also held a consultative conference to which a large number of stakeholders, both in higher education, public, private, and outside higher education, were invited, also October 2009. And the four themes that were discussed there were access and success, and especially the emphasis on access and admission of students with a view to successful students coming out on the other side, and I'd like to say something about that later. We looked at another theme, diversity in higher education, especially transformational issues. We looked at higher education's role in a developmental state, and particularly in relation to the developmental goals of our present government. And the fourth theme was that of knowledge and higher education, or the research environment and higher education. What would be our main challenges? Our main challenges would be that the issue around private higher education providers, one is not always sure exactly how many learners there are in the private higher education system. Our estimate at the moment is it's about 67,000, and we're tidying up a lot on the private higher education data system, which at the moment doesn't function and exist in a properly conceptualized way. Learner data, we are working together with the South African Qualifications Authority around establishing proper learner databases for learners in higher education, not per institution but systemically, which also doesn't exist at the moment. And then the CHE is finding itself to play an increasingly larger role in disseminating higher education information of a variety of sorts. Much of it has to deal with a vexing issue of different admission requirements which different institutions levy or set, which causes quite some difficulties for the general public. On the advisory function chair, we advised the Minister on Transformation and Discrimination Report, Professor Crane Sudeen. Work in progress around the use of the name university in South Africa by new institutions, particularly privates, but not only so, also publics.
we're quite far down the line with advice on a four-year general first degree instead of a present three-year first degree. We've launched and are continuing this year with a large project on student support and success in learning. And I'd like to say one or two words about this. The first leg of the project involved a pilot study where we analyzed the support systems of institutions in terms of supporting students in their learning endeavors. And this pilot study has showed some very interesting results. For example, we have found, and admittedly it's only a pilot and it involved only about 7 of the 23 public institutions, found, for example, that students on the average, and there's no race difference in this particular case, on the average spend as much time socializing as they do studying per week. And that was somewhat surprising because one would have thought that given the pressures on succeeding, given the cost of higher education, you would have found that time for socializing was less limited or was more limited than is actually the case. We did find some differences in interesting factors. Whether they're statistically significant, we're still investigating. And class attendance, for example, in the usage of counseling facilities offered by universities, etc., we are now doing an in-depth analysis of that, and the CHE this year has awarded a further close to R1 million to take this particular project further, and we had a big workshop with higher education institutions on the 5th of March around this particular issue, and especially that success part there, which obviously is vital and crucial, because what's the point of having a massive pipeline of inflow and a very much thinner pipeline of outflow? And the challenge for us in higher education is to get these two pipelines to be more equal in terms of the in and outflow numbers. We are looking at the law curriculum. That's a request from the Law Society. And the areas for investigation, Chair, which we think, but we are hoping to talk to the department about that, to obtain a greater alignment between what the CHE does and what the department sees as the challenges which it faces, would be the issue of differentiation, tacitly or otherwise, in the higher education system and funding. There are some institutions that have great difficulties in making ends meet more so than others. We think that the whole issue of the role of higher education in a post-school education and training system is a vital one. And personally, that's my own feeling, that this is probably the biggest challenge that we face, is establishing an integrated, cohesive, and functional post-school education and training system in which higher education is one of the components, but not the only one. And then, Chair, we're dealing with a crucial problem, what I call the aging professoriate. Most of our academics that produce in terms of research outputs are over the age of 50, 55, and most of them are white and they're males. And we're having great difficulties in replacing these people with new academics who also contribute to the race and gender improvement of institutional profiles. Chair, Quality Assurance, the Higher Education Amendment Act of 2008, together with the NQF Act, has made the CHE a Quality Council for Higher Education, which means that the CHE is now in law responsible for the accreditation of all higher education programs as stipulated in the Higher Education Qualifications Framework. Previously, there was some lack of clarity around this issue and the role of the professional councils. That should now be cleared up, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. There are two other quality councils, the Quality Council for Trade and Occupations, which was launched a short while ago, and then Umalusi. And these three quality councils form then the quality councils which will oversee education, quality assurance at the various levels in terms of the various qualification frameworks. Challenges. Chair, we've got to absorb at the CHE a number of additional functions in terms of the NQF Act and the HUQF, amongst other standard setting. So standard setting moves from SACWA as a previous responsibility to the CHE for higher education. We are working hard on establishing a very constructive relationship with the professional councils really accreditation of qualifications, because clearly I don't think our society and the public needs it to have the CHE and the professional councils working independently of one another in this field and just causing much more administration and logistical arrangements for institutions. Chair, we had a meeting chaired by the Director General of the Department last week on a crucial matter, and that is to establish a forum between the quality councils as part of a cooperative approach around educational issues which may have been missing in the past. And the three quality councils are fully committed to participate in the establishment of a QC forum where cross-cutting issues will be dealt with, hopefully then working together in an integrated manner, supporting common goals rather than working against one another. There are some critical amendments to the HEQF which require urgent attention. That is not a CHE responsibility in the first place, but one of the department. The minister owns the Higher Education Qualifications Framework. It's gazetted by him. But, for example, the introduction of a 360 credit or a three-year vocational or technologically oriented degree is, I believe, of crucial importance to the socioeconomic development of our country, and at this point in time it's not possible as the HEQF stands now. Chair, on accreditation, we have a number of processes. These are online. You can issue an application online. These applications are evaluated by external evaluators, and then we have an accreditation committee, and after that the Higher Education Quality Committee looks at this, and we've also now introduced an appeals process where especially private providers but also public providers can appeal on the outcome of an accreditation process as part of streamlining issues around administrative justice in that regard. Our challenges are, Chair, we need to move faster on self-accreditation for institutions who warrant that and who deserve that. The issue of compliance of existing qualifications with the HETF is a massive issue, and the Minister will at some time or other announce a date by which all higher education qualifications should comply with the HEQF, which will give standard setting and quality assurance on a broad systemic front a massive boost forward. We have to look, as part of this, at the reaccreditation of all these qualifications, and then, Chair, at the moment, there's pretty much of a free-for-all around the designation of qualifications. The CHE is tasked to develop criteria for the designation of qualifications. We are working in terms of a set of interim criteria, but not yet in terms of a set of final criteria. National reviews. A while back, we launched a national review on all MBA programs, and we deaccredited about 8, a couple amongst the privates, and also a couple amongst the publics. After that, we've done a national review on teacher education programs, and we're finalizing that report, but that also led to the deaccreditation of a couple of M-Ed programs, especially in the M-Ed management field, and the CHE is now looking at resuscitating this function fully. Our funds are limited in this regard, but we are trying to see whether through reprioritization we can't resurrect this function fully and not a little bit limping along as we've done the last while. Institutional audits. Chair, we hope to complete the first cycle of our institutional audits by 2011. That means all public institutions will then have undergone a comprehensive institutional audit and will have presented the CHE and the education sector with a comprehensive database on the publics. We've also done some institutional audits for privates, but not for all. In the last year and a half, we've done UNISA, Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University, UKZN, Northwest University, UJ, and as we sit here at this point in time, the University of Zululand is undergoing its institutional audit. Our challenges here are, Chair, we've got to complete this by the year 2011. Our lessons that we've learned should be incorporated in a changed audit manual, which hopefully will become less labor-intensive. And then we've got to make much better use within the CHE of the data generated by our institutional audits in our advisory function. Quality promotion, members will be pleased to know that we launched and we hope to be signing soon a project involving the South African Union of Student Associations, with quality promotion and quality assurance, and we hope to be signing a charter in the next few weeks with them around student support and buy-in around the whole notion of quality assurance. Our challenges here are the continued building of quality assurance capacity in the HE system, particularly at the institutional level. And, Chair, more and more we are finding that the CHE is being called on to play a role within the SADC community and wider abroad around quality assurance and quality promotion. I can just say that a while back we had three staff members from the Botswana Council on Higher Education for 3 days with us, and they have now issued a formal request where the two of their staff members can't come and work on a secondment basis at the cost of the Botswana Council on Higher Education for a year in the CHE. We hope to be signing a memorandum of understanding with the Rwandan CHE. We've negotiated and concluded similar agreements with the Ghanaian Council on Higher Education, etc. I was in Namibia recently, and their CHE CEO asked me whether the CHE should not take the lead, the South African CHE, in establishing a SADC network around quality assurance and roles of councils of higher education. My response to him was, we would be very happy to do so, but provided this was not interpreted as South Africa feeling that we were ahead of the bunch, we were learning together with each, and all of us could learn from one another. But probably we will do so. Such quality assurance networks exist the world over, and they are of immense help in the whole system of peer evaluation. Chair, from my side, that's it. I will be happy to deal with mission-related issues, and Dr. Birkus will now take over.
Thank you. And can we do this, Honorable Professor? Let's allow, before we now get into that operational detail, let's allow our members to engage on some of these strategic matters. I also would want to welcome the leadership of the students. I'm noting the hands of our members. Mr. James?
Thank you very much to Mr. Stumpf. You speak a lot of quality and quality assurance, and I always wonder how one measures the quality of degrees and whether there is a testing mechanism beyond the fact that students are employed. And so how much is a degree from the University of Limpopo worth to a student? What is a BA worth to a student from the University of Limpopo as opposed to the University of the Witwatersrand? How does one, in terms of quality assurance, certify the quality of the academic offerings within a higher education institution, is my question.
Any other end?
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want clarification on four-year general first degree. Can you, Professor, try and unpack it and tell us what does it involve? Is perhaps the honors degree inbuilt in it, or it's just a flat degree? And secondly, just a comment here, the problem of aging professoriate and their disappearance from the academic arena. I'm saying the same is experienced at the school and system level, where teachers are also aging and dying of HIV AIDS and resigning, and young people who are produced in matric are not interested in teaching because it's not an attractive field of employment, given the salary and the working conditions and all sorts of things involved there. Thank you.
Thank you, Member Buinamo. Member Lekhesho.
Thank you, Chair. Let me say up front that I'm very happy for the presentation, and at the same time, stunned But it's something that I've been observing also myself, that students spend most of their time socializing. And that should be a very worrying trend. You see,
you don't declare your secrets, Member Lehecha.
Yeah. And I'm saying it's very worrying, you see. Most of the time they are on TVs. They don't study. How do you cap this? The second question, you talk about post-school, mm-hmm. post-schooling. Can you please detail this? Because most of our students, we see many, many dropouts. And these people, they participate in matches. One would conclude that they are taught to a certain standard, leave school, go and toy. That is a sizable number of those children. I just want to know, how do you intervene? Thanks.
Goodbye. And then I think I'll allow you to respond, and then I'll go to the others.
Thanks, Jeff. My first question is around the quality assurance of programs, short-term programs offered by institutions. An example is the content that goes to programs such as the one that offered by VET business schools. Those short, what impact and what role do you play in just quality assuring those programs? Just to understand that there's been some concern coming out in terms of the content that goes into those programs, though they are accredited, not to the level that you would expect them to be provided by VETs as well. Secondly, to the issue of access that you spoke about. Just to try and understand, you spoke about student support and success, but again, in your document, it reflects on some of the key areas that we'd want to interact with. As I think on the document itself, it's at page 7, where you speak about student access and success. If you can just elaborate on that, what you mean. Does this mean in terms of your, do you have a role in terms of the institution as the intake students? Requirements, standardization, if there's any, what role do you play there as the institution?
Fine. I'll allow you, Professor, but just as a context to response, I've got quite a few questions as well, but I will not ask it at this moment. But just as a context, you did raise the issue that what is higher education's role in a developmental state? Can you tell us what is the perspective of the Council for Higher Education of a developmental state and higher education's role in that? And then you can deal with the specific questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me start with the last one. One of the issues that I think faces higher education and a whole society, that there does not seem to be a generally accepted understanding and notion of what particularly characterizes a developmental state. People have different views of what characterizes a developmental state. And at some council, university council workshops that I've been able to facilitate and mediate on, this particular issue has always cropped up, that if you ask an institution to be responsive to the challenges facing a developmental state, they ask, can you please tell us what is a developmental state? And that is probably part of a larger national debate which doesn't seem to have been driven to conclusion yet. My response to that is that whether there is unanimity or actual agreement on that particular issue is, I don't think, sufficient reason for a university to say we have to wait until that debate has been conclusively concluded before we can move. We all know that the present government has got a number of priorities. We know that education is one of them. We know that health is one of them. We know that the development of the rural areas and poverty alleviation is one of them. We know that issues around security and crime is one, and there are a host of these. There are five major ones, and these are supported by sub-priorities. What would be incumbent on universities, I believe, and some universities have done it, but not necessarily so, is for them to investigate particularly their learning programs, to investigate their research themes in which they operate, and to investigate and analyze their community service programs, and see what is the alignment between their learning programs, between their research endeavors, and the community service programs and these priorities. Let me give you an example. The University of Limpopo, to which Honorable Member James referred to earlier, is a good example. They run a BSc program in water and sanitation. If you analyze the content, and it's no longer so, let me hasten to add, if you analyze the content of that program, it was aimed very much at what I would call first world or development or developed nation physics, hydrology, chemistry, etc. in the program of water and sanitation. And when we had the cholera outbreak, which was particularly prevalent in that province, I happened to be doing work for that university in another context. The first question came up, but where is the university in terms of the challenges faced around clean water? And the university's response was, we have such a program, but when we analyzed the program, we saw it wasn't geared towards the developmental challenges which we face in our country, which are not highfalutin, first world standards in this particular case around groundbreaking new theories around chemical compounds, etc., etc. But it was simply around how do you ensure through your academic contribution the provision of clean water to people, especially in the rural areas. So universities, I do think, have got some homework to do and make sure that they work more closely, and I'm not saying 100% matches, but more closely is aligned to at least some of those developmental priorities. If I can come to the first question, the BA Limpopo, really the BA Wits was just an example used. How can you say this? This is a difficult question because it's a little bit like the South African Bureau of Standards. They can say these are the minimum standards, but over and above the minimum, there could still be differences in a particular product. And the CHE, through its accreditation exercise and now with its standard-setting function, will be able to say these are the minimum standards, these are the minimum criteria and norms which have to be satisfied by every single qualification offered in South Africa. And in that respect, one would be able to say that there has to be a minimum comparability of qualifications across the whole system when all the standards have been set and all the qualifications have been accredited. But that will not guarantee that one qualification from one institution will be exactly the same as that of another institution. There will be subtle differences. These differences could be with the quality of the staff, the quality of infrastructure, which could have variations in terms of surpassing the minimum requirements that have been set. So quality assurance can never say that the product from institution A and the product from institution B will in all respects be equal. It's not possible. What we can say is that the product from both these institutions will satisfy the minimum requirements set by a body such as the Council on Higher Education. The four-year general first degree, Chair, we have followed a more colonial approach around our 3-1 structure, which has come under pressure. Many universities actually have more degree enrollments in 4-year professional programs than they have in their 3-year general degree programs. We also find that due to knowledge developments, more and more students require knowledge exposure in areas which perhaps they didn't require last year. 30 years ago, students didn't really need and exposure into computer literacy and basic IT issues. Now every single student, doesn't matter what you study, whether you study BA languages, sociology, right through to engineering, every single student needs a course or more in computer literacy. We're finding more and more that students also require some exposure to the principles of logic, to the principle of critical analysis, to the principles of analyzing documentation, to the principles of simply being able to synthesize a document into its essence. These are typically issues that you are taught in a course on logic. And so more and more we're finding that the three-year curriculum simply doesn't have enough space for adding new additional components. Many universities have found that regardless of what you study, you need some exposure, you need a course in ethics. And so more and more universities are finding their 360 credit curriculum is simply becoming too crammed. It's too full. And so there is some pressure on moving towards the USA model, where you have a four-year liberal arts qualification, which all students take. Now, we may not be able to go exactly that route, but certainly the notion is you either just simply tell students you've got to get all of this in your own time, or you've got to take away learning time from the major subjects, for example, mathematics or history or whatever the case may be, and make space in your 360 curriculum for that. In addition, we are finding that large numbers of students in any case take 4 years over a three-year degree and even longer. And so all these issues, at the request of the former Minister of Higher Education, are being investigated by the CHE. Some countries have followed a two-by-two model. In some countries, after 2 years, you get awarded an associate baccalaureate degree, and then after another two, you get your baccalaureate degree. And so all these issues are under investigation, and to come back to the first question, which the Honorable Chair asked, that is part and parcel of what I would regard as a response to the challenges facing a developmental state, is to look at whether the colonial type of model that we inherited in terms of the three-year degree followed by an honors is still appropriate for the challenges which we face in South Africa. Now, the outcome of this is not entirely clear, and obviously a cost-benefit analysis has to be done. Will the benefits outweigh or at least match the additional cost of a formal four-year degree? And we're busy with that. Aging professoriate, the issues are probably well known to the members. Universities have found that their salaries for academia are lagging behind considerably. And as the Honorable Member pointed out, that the academia is simply no longer an attractive profession for many young people, and the answers for that are simple. You have to study so long and so hard and so far before you actually become a valued member of the academia, and most universities require a PhD to be appointed as a lecturer, if not as a lecturer, at least as a senior lecturer. If you haven't got that, you can't be appointed as a senior lecturer. And that means
I wonder, can we also get a reflection on some of what is the advice being given?
Okay.
I'm very interested. One of the difficulties that I've got with what I'm experiencing many times through either the structures of higher education and training presenting here, is we are hearing the problem and the problem and the problem. Mm. I'm not hearing, and I've listened very careful to the presentation. We always hear about the analysis of this problem. Now the issue here is we can analyze and we can analyze and we can analyze, and we are getting our dropouts and we are getting our dropouts and we're continuing analyzing. So I would want to suggest that rather reposition the responses in the question in the context of what is the type of interventions that Council for Higher Education is advising.
Chair, that's one of the issues which I certainly hope the department and the new CEO will resolve very quickly. I do not believe, and it's easy for me to talk, I'm out of this job by the end of April, but I do not believe that the CHE and the department can afford to carry on working as they did in the past. They have to cooperate with one another far more without jeopardizing one another's independence and judicial mandate areas. To the best of my knowledge, the CHE has never approached the department and said, can you give us a list of the issues that you would like us to advise you on? What the CHE does, it waits for the minister to write them a letter, or it decides on its own what it's going to look at. And so, Chair, that's the first response I want to make. As part of what I believe is an approach to cooperative governance, I would look for far greater synergy between the department saying, these are our priorities, we're not sure whether the minister will actually ask you for advice on these issues, but these are our priorities. Can you prepare yourself for some points of view on these issues, please? At the moment, Chair, and I apologize for that, it's not happening. But I certainly think in the new dispensation, and I had some discussion with the acting DDG earlier on, we are confident that this problem will be resolved, which will enable the CHE to be far better positioned to give advice which is needed by the public custodian of higher education, namely the Department of Higher Education and Training. Around the aging professoriate, advice that could be given, Chair, would simply to make the conditions of employment far more attractive for academia than they are at present. And universities are busy doing that. The ultimate issue, Chair, is the issue of funding. The advice would simply be that universities have to be enabled to fund their academia at higher levels. At the moment, a professor at the average university earns less or perhaps equal to that of a director in the civil service. And the average professor would not get a car allowance. And so this is a serious issue, and you may say to me, well, that's an easy cop-out, it's a money issue. Yes, Chair, it is. There's no getting away from it. If you ask a young black person, why don't you enter academia, they say, why should I? I can get paid much more quickly out there than following the long, arduous route of getting a PhD and then ending up. So, somehow, Chair, we have to make it more attractive, and to make things attractive without addressing the money issue is simply moving the deck chairs on the Titanic around. The issue of student learning support, Chair, our advice would probably be around this issue. One of the issues, areas of advice would be that universities have to embark on concerted efforts to make residences areas of learning rather than boarding houses. And some universities in the USA, and I'm not advocating we should follow them all, are ahead of us. Some universities in the USA will take their residence, their hostel. They will convert some of the rooms into lecture halls. They will actually have some teaching taking place in that residence. They will arrange that some of the academic staff have their offices in the residence. They will place some of the learning support divisions, counseling, for example, student financial aid, for example, in the residences, to make the residences a place where active learning support is available and where actual learning takes place. At the moment, to our shame, if a student wants to learn, many of them have to escape from the residence into the library because there's too much noise going on in the residences. So, Chair, that's one facet of advice, and I'm very pleased that the department is launching or considering to launch an investigation into the infrastructural requirements around residences. And if we simply end up providing more beds, we're missing the point. It's not about more beds. It's about changing the whole culture of a residence into a learning environment and making academic staff realize that they are part and parcel of that culture and that they party to the students learning in a residence rather than simply switching on the TV all the time and sitting in the coffee room, etc. Post-schooling, some detail, Chair, our advice on this issue would be and I'm speaking brashly, is that this presents the single greatest challenge to the minister, we believe. And the reason for that is simple. You cannot take the 700,000 students, which according to the community survey of 2007, have either the old N3, before the NVC was established, or grade 12, and have passed it, and can carry on with higher education, who are not working, they're not employed, and neither are they studying, and neither are they disabled. There's 700,000 young people, as you and I sit here, sitting out in the streets, who either have the N3 or the N12, they're not working, they're not studying. If you add the dropouts from grade 10, 11, and 12 to that, the figure becomes 2.8 million people, young people, who are doing nothing, who are waiting. It's futile and ludicrous to expect the universities to pick up these numbers. They can't. In any event, the unit cost at a university is too high. We've got to find facilities with a lower unit cost to act as an initial catch-up for many of these ones who should be learning to have their potential fulfilled and for society to benefit. That is the post-school education and training system. You may ask, what is in it? Chair, that's conjecture. I think the minister is busy with work on that. I have my views on that. The CHE is developing some views on that. Our advice certainly would be that it should be characterized as a single system rather than just parts that talk to one another. It should be characterized by integration, which means that students should have pathways to follow between the various parts of the system. And rather than create new institutions straight away, it should look at the existing institutions and see to which degree these can be incorporated into a single system. You say, which are they? Chair, they are the universities. They're the two institutes for higher education. They're the FET colleges. And I know that the nursing colleges and the agricultural colleges fall under different ministries. But from a systemic point of view, it would make a lot of sense if there were connectednesses developed between those two types of institutions, and there are many, and the universities, FET colleges. What should happen? FET colleges should be capacitated, should be strengthened, should be enlarged to play a much greater role, and some of those who are able to should be allowed to offer lower level higher education qualifications, such as higher certificates, for example, in tourism and hospitality, or a higher certificate in IT, etc. So quality assurance, short-term programs, what the CHE does, it has delegated the quality assurance for short-term programs to individual providers, which would be one, provided they meet the requirements for such delegation, and not all necessarily do, in which case the quality assurance of such short-term programs remains with the CHE. The issue here at stake is content issues. The CHE's delegations requirements do not drill down into the content. And that could be well an area in which the CHE may have to look, although it does bring one into the very difficult area of institutional autonomy and academic freedom, and it would have to be a negotiated and facilitated entry into that field, which is subject to broad systemic criteria rather than individual content criteria. Access, I've already said something on the issues of success. Chair, let me embark on this a little bit more. We all know about the National Benchmark Test. We all know about the introduction of the National Senior Certificate in its curriculum. People may wonder, but is that not the problem? No, I don't think that. The curriculum is not the problem. There are other problems of a systemic nature in the school system, which fall outside the CHE's purview. But what the CHE can do and what it is doing is simply to say to universities which long have said, well, this is not our problem, solve the school system and the problem will go away for us. It's not going to go away, number one. No university system, whether you in the USA or in Finland, which is reported to have the best higher education system in the world, gets students in the state and readiness of preparation that they would wish to. It's not happening. It won't happen in South Africa, it's not happening in the USA, it's not happening in Finland. What should be done? universities should shoulder a far greater responsibility around learning support. I've already mentioned one avenue would be the advice on making your universities, your residences, learning support centers. Chair, we are still living, believe it or not, in a day and age where many libraries and many of the IT computer support centers are stocked in libraries, are not open 24/7 in South Africa. Very simple issue. Open those libraries 24/7 to support student success. Make sure that you've got IT facilitators to help students, because the internet access at the university 2 o'clock at night is far faster than it is at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And students have different hours than we do. Many of them seem to be able to do with far less sleep. Universities, unfortunately also, Chair, I have to say this, not all of them, many of them use their facilities up till 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. The modern day university has to use their facilities right into the evening in supporting students. The advice of the CHE Chair will be that although many universities pay lip service to student centers, for many academics, and it's an embarrassment for me to say so as a former academic, for many academics, students are actually a bit of a bother, because what they actually would like to do is research. And we have to get the primary focus and function of our institutions on learning and learning support back. Does that mean anti-research? No. But it does mean that primarily the taxpayer funds universities to produce graduates, and that these graduates have to be able to successfully contribute to the furtherance of socioeconomic goals of the country. Chair, I'm finished with the first lot, and I'd be happy to elaborate on any issue that members may feel I didn't touch sufficiently on.
Thank you. I want to say that at least I think it's the very first time that I'm feeling that I'm starting to hear after the intervention that I've made there from a institution linked up with higher education, that I'm starting to hear some form of advice. Because, as I've said, it's always just an analysis of problems. What would be of interest is if we, in fact, talk about the success and how do we achieve the success rate, as just before I allow you to ask further questions, members, what would your advice be and why don't we have, last week I've asked the Department of Higher Education, what is the actual percentage in reduction of dropouts come end of 2010? Meaning, obviously, after the subs is being done early next year. But what is it? Because we're paralyzed. We can quote figures, wonderful figures, of how people are not getting through, there's not a throughput, and we can make that analysis. But here we come at 2010, end of this year. I didn't find in the strat plan of the department, on questioning the department, I didn't find, for example, that there is a reduction in the percentage that I'm hearing. What, for example, was that question I posed to you? Did Council for Higher Education analyze it? But come end of this year, why can't we actually just implement some of the things? You know, the I don't know if members have picked up, we consider to, not CHE now, but there's a consideration of an investigation to do an analysis on residences and how to make it a learning environment. Guess what? Isn't there obvious things that we can just do to make it a learning environment? So we are doing meetings, we're having forums, we're having all of these discussions, and there is some practical responses that we should just implement. I wonder if you just wanted to say something on the throughput end. Why can't we just get a better target end of this year? But keep that. I'm parking that. It's because this issue was raised last week, and precisely because we are concerning about action and not analysis only. Also to the president of the student body, also just welcome to you. Let me hand over to, is it member Kuban, and then Fukuza, and member Gina, and Magazi, and yourself. So it's five.
Thanks, Chair. Firstly, just following up on the first question that I asked, is it the second question on the short courses? The reason I raised it is because it's a bit of a challenge if an institution is going to become a referee and a player at the same time. Because if an institution would have to do their own quality assurance in what they produce and you delegate that mandate, hence I asked it because starting to pick up some of these challenges that are existing. For me, it's the same thing of though they are credible institutions, they can be able to hide behind non-credible causes. Whereas if it's an institution that is not really credible, you are easy to pick that up. If it's a college that exists in a little corner somewhere that does something wrong, you are able to pick up. But if they are done within this institution that we hold high regard of, and their regulation themselves, their quality assuring themselves, it becomes a challenge. So I'm saying that's why I raised this issue, Chair, is to say, this needs to be looked at in terms of the quality assuring of those programs to ensure that we don't end up with programs that are similar to what any other college can offer in a little corner, either in Johannesburg or in Pretoria. So that's a concern for me. That's why I raised this matter specifically. But yeah, again, coming back to the issue of even access, and I'm glad to hear the comments around what we see in the institutions that you find academics feeling that it's more of a burden. Because that translates in how academics and not the relation between the lecturers and the students. I mean, we've had few engagement with students in the institutions that we've been to. And you can see the frustration from students, lack of support, what you are raising, all those things. And if we are to respond in such a manner that education and how we do things, education is a priority, and therefore it's a way of removing, turning around the clock, even addressing the issues of poverty in this country, we've got to turn things around in institution and how we do things. And quite honestly, it's unfortunate that you're raising these issues fresh, so, and going, you say you're going out. And I'm hoping whoever comes in would also have this fresh, you know, ideal way of looking at things, that we've got to have institutions looking at teaching and learning as a primary function. Mm. Academics in terms of research is important to increase the level of your understanding and all that, but mainly to ensuring that student support and student teaching happens within institutions. So that's why I wanted to raise that as well, to say it's quite refreshing and we'll quite monitor throughout the time. But I don't know whether this one goes to the department, and unfortunately, for me, either it's the difficulty of reading. It would have been better to see in terms of saying this is what a program that we are involved in. I tried, but I saw the risk areas specifically. But I thought in terms of targets, as the institution saying this is what would happen by this time, so that it makes it easier for us as a committee to be able to evaluate you and to say this is what you have committed to doing by this time, and therefore you have not been able to do that. But without specific time frames, it becomes a bit a challenge for us. So what I would have preferred to see is specific time frames on doing certain activities, not only on the risk factors, but on activities and programs that the institution is involved in. Thanks, Chair.
Good memory, Vukuza.
Thank you, Chair. Professor Stumpf, thank you for your input. You're speaking of a single system, you're speaking of integration and all those things. And I'm sitting here and I'm wondering, we have, since last year, been having so many agencies and bodies of education coming in here. And I'm just wondering whether we don't need a single kind of integrated system at that level as well. Because I hear so many voices. I hear that it's not a single system. It's many voices in higher education. They all come here, and I think we're the only body where everybody comes to speak. So we are able to hear who's speaking past each other. So we need a single system that begins at this level. And then I'm sure it can be easier if it were to cascade down. I hear so many voices. I'm listening to you and I'm jealous and I'm hearing and I'm wondering if anybody else is hearing the kinds of interventions you're talking about. Because those interventions are so good to hear at this level, but whoever must do something about them, do they hear? What is your own play in the sphere of education system? Where is your voice and who's listening to it and are you saying it where it should be said? So I'm hearing this and I'm like saying, how do we make one of this voice a voice together with other voices to hear this single cohesive message in higher education? Because there have been so many interventions over time. Education system is patches on patches on patches. It's like an old machine that has got so many motors that must come and work. And something is just not getting on. And while I'm that, I would want to hear, because I think somewhere in my life, in fact, I'm one of the academics that fell by the wayside exactly because of those conditions. You know, there was a time in my life I thought, what is the value of learning if it is so cheap at the end of the day, you know. But then again, I know that Chair at a certain point recommended the merging of universities and technicons and so on. What is happening there? Can you really tell us what is happening? Because we seem to be fixing and fixing, and yes, we must. Even now we are trying to fix. And I'd like to hear what your sense is between the integration or the migration or the, I don't know what the word is. We still have to find a word between higher education and the skills and training to see. What is that marriage all about? Is that a marriage? Is that a partnership? What is that? So that none ends up being a poor cousin of the other. So I'm really interested to hear about these measures and whether what you are saying couldn't be factored into some of those other things. Again, the president during SONA spoke about, of course this can be a slogan, it can be a cliche, it can be anything, but he spoke about us being, you know, better, faster and smarter. What is that in higher education that can be done that way and faster to cater for the kind of 2.8 million youth that you're talking about who are not anywhere? Thank you.
Thank you. Member Gina.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the first part, I think Comrade Vuvuzela has well covered me, because I was also concerned about the relationship that we have, especially with the Department of Education, as to say those channels, are they open enough so that you can sit down and discuss those things, since we are focusing on one thing, we want to deliver quality education to our learners. So that was my main concern. Secondly, I want to know about when you are quality assuring the institutions, some of the programs that are there. There are programs that are said to be partially accredited, but you see that they are continuing being offered in those schools. What impact does that have on our learners? Just to say they are busy continuing with these, meaning that maybe there are requirements that they are not yet there, but those programs are being continually offered to those students. And lastly, can you have said that you are part of SADC now. Just a brief comparison as to where are we as South Africa comparing to other countries, to other African countries. I know you have said we are all there to learn from each other, but really, where can you position the education system that we have in South Africa compared to the African countries that we have around here when you sit there in that study? Thank you very much.
Madam McGill.
Oh, thanks, Chairperson. Professor, actually, I wanted to interject, you know, while you were doing your presentation, because you said something on the national benchmarking. You mentioned that one of the things that we could do is to open the libraries for 24 hours. I mean, for students, you know, to study and better themselves. But what just came into my mind is that have you also looked at the, because I think there's a reason why these libraries, they have a short hours,
because of the crime, women abuse, all sorts of, you know, all sorts of crime. I don't know whether you have also thought about that. And also, if not, can you just think about it? And also, what strategies or advices where we can make universities, if it be, if they become 24 hours open, what strategies or advices you can give so that you make sure that students, they don't get hurt?
Person, Member Ponsano.
Thank you, Chair. Prof, can I just take you back a little bit on this concept of developmental state, because it's very interesting. Thank you, Chair, for raising it. And, I know defining any term is very problematic, but my question would be, taking your definition of a developmental state, would that require also a re-look at, for instance, admission requirements by different... I know we'll have institutional differences when it comes to admission of students to universities. But I know for now that alone is very... probably closes the door to many students. And second, you talk about, you mentioned about institutional reviews. I didn't quite get what the objectives are and what the outcome would be. What's your end in view? With what end in view do you embark on that, on such a process? Thank you.
Member Sadebe.
Well, my question my question was related to the student support. I understand the issue of maybe providing more access to libraries to being open 24 hours and the likes. But there was a sort of a system that has been also been provided to these private schools, so-called private schools previously, multiracials, whereby some certain programs that has been provided to students, preparing them also to go to university, but also students that are at the university getting more support from their own lectures when they see sort of a gap. You know, I was a student of engineering. There was a time whereby some of us were challenges in terms of, you know, doing digital systems. The lecturers took initiative of running extra classes, supporting systems, and also noticing that some of us were disadvantaged in terms of having all materials, but they could be able to provide more support in terms of that. That made us to be more excelling in terms of those studies. I'm trying to change maybe in terms of, you know, such kind of a program that should be extended. So that, you know, we must do, you know, a holistic approach of support, but not only a focus into libraries only, but a holistic approach in terms of this support. I think it will be able also to assist, because that's where also it has been noticed that some of the students that, you know, they couldn't be able to afford financially, they could be able to be identified there, because as I was saying, the lecture that, you know, we had there, I think it was a person that also grew up under the very same frustration of not getting financial support. As a result, that when he identified several students that couldn't be able to get financial support, he managed to go outside
approaching companies to come and assist paying finances or fees for the students so that they can be able to proceed. As a matter of, you know, the barrier that was also created in terms of the financial schemes that they be provided at that time. I'm looking at the holistic approach in terms of the support of students. But well, the other aspect that you've just mentioned is that one of the other challenges that you also had is the, you know, issue of transformation and be able to also match between white lecturers and black lecturers so that you can be able to get a whole formal combination. I couldn't get it clearly clarified to say what was the challenge exactly. Why couldn't you be able to get a holistic approach? But also to check what are the other possibilities that you can be able to ensure that all those previous good lecturers that they have been there, old as they are, I could see some of them, they're getting gray hair, that, you know, they'll be going to pension late sooner. But what are the possibilities of, you know, withdrawing them or attracting them so that they can be able to come and assist with some certain, you know, strategies of providing better teacher education? Because I think it's one of the other challenges that you also have in South Africa. Thank you.
Can I request, Professor, possibly just to, I'm going to allow you 7 minutes to respond and not necessarily to give all the general information also. I think you've contextualized the issues up front well. You drilled down into some of the strategic advice, and most probably we can just get sharp responses.
Thank you very much, Chair. Very quickly, just say the issue of can we establish a single integrated system? I think this clearly is a challenge for the department, but certainly in which we all have a role to play. I believe so, provided we put the student first. If we don't put the student first, we're going to end up squabbling about structures and turf and who knows what sorts of things. So that may sound like a glib response, but I really mean it. We need, amongst all the role players, a uniting agenda, and the uniting agenda, in my view, has to be the learner. Can't be anything else. It can't be what we are or our positions or practices in the past or whatever. Chair, provisional accreditation conditions, we accredit a program provisionally or not at all. With a provisional accreditation, we normally set a number of conditions. Some are conditions which have to be met prior to the commencement of the offering of the program, so the institution is not allowed to offer that program unless they satisfy the CHE. We put X, Y, and Z in place. Others are short-term. You can start, but within 3 months or 6 months, you have to do this. Others are even long-term. An institution that is not accredited has the right to make a representation. If a representation fails again, then it can make an appeal on an appeals committee. We also ask institutions that have not achieved full accreditation to submit improvement plans. And these improvement plans are looked at every meeting of the Higher Education Quality Committee, and institutions have to submit these from time to time. SADC system, how do we face? Chair, I'm not an expert on the school system, so I can't comment on that. But as far as the higher education system is concerned in general, as far as the SADC countries are concerned, I would argue that the South African higher education system is probably by far the best. If you say, how can you prove it? There are international rankings, and for Africa, the South African universities occupy, I think, the first 14 places. Of the African university rankings. The University of Cairo was the one that came first of other non-South African universities. So certainly the higher education system, and I hope it doesn't sound arrogant, but we are in the leadership around that. Chair, then, library safety, woman abuse. Yes, Chair, this is unfortunately an issue, but I would argue it's not entirely non-resolvable. Universities can succeed a long way with additional security arrangements around this issue, targeted security, staff being provided, adequate lighting being provided, which many institutions have done, to make use of so-called, what would you call them, patrols to walk with students when they walk from the library back to their residence. Some universities have found ways maybe not to eliminate the security risk, but certainly to lessen it. Chair, very quickly, the developmental state admission requirements articulation. Yes, Chair, this is one of the great problems we have. We operate in a system which is largely characterized by non-articulation. What does this mean? This means we've got no systemic arrangements that if you've completed your study at this particular institution, you can slot with effortlessly into such and such a place at that and that institution. The USA has such a system, but we don't. So the advice is we have to develop a credit accumulation and transfer system which is systemic and national in its impact, and which will not issue in dead-end streets for students who studied in one institution and then find they can't carry on in another one. National reviews, our aim there, Chair, is simply to improve the quality. The MBAs, we shut down a number of MBAs in the private sector and also three in the public sector, which were simply below quality and which were taking individual students for a ride. Student support, holistic, fully supported. Writing centers, students don't know how to write essays. They don't know how to write exams. Study methods, students don't know how to study. They need guidance in developing study methods. They don't know how to extract maximum benefit from attending a class. Many have to be taught. They come from dysfunctional school systems. A university has to have that support system. Assessment, aptitude. What is your aptitude for? Are you studying the right direction or not? Leadership development. Many universities simply allow clubs and societies to form rather than utilizing those in a proactive way to develop leadership capabilities amongst our students. Chair, let me stop with that. And then lastly, what do we do to attract especially black academic lecturers? Chair, I don't know. This is not a cop-out. But unless we can pay more, we're not going to attract the numbers of black academics that we want who are of the appropriate quality. And there are members here in other capacities who are at institutions. Professor Fitzgerald is one of them. They will know this is not for a lack of trying. In fact, some higher education institutions have reversed in terms of the number of African academics over the last 3-4 years. They've now been less than they had 3-4 years ago. They've had an outflow, and they haven't been able to match it with an inflow. And the salaries is the fundamental issue. If that's not going to be resolved, we're not going to resolve it. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks a lot. Let's immediately go over to the other part of this presentation, and I'll call on members not to ask too many questions. Thank you, Chair. Good morning, members of the Portfolio Committee. I will just briefly talk you through. Sorry, is this thing working?
Professor Stim, just
okay. Now it's better. I will briefly talk you through two things, and this is the financials and the HR. Okay. This graph is a reflection of the history of the CHE. The CHE was established about 10 years ago, and from 1999 till about 2002, the organization's activities were mainly sustained by means of donor funding. And then gradually there was a government grant added to that, and there was a steady growth in the government grant till about 2005, and then in 2005-2006 there was an intervention from the department. There was a top slicing of the budget of the higher education, and it was given to the university based on the understanding that whatever the CHE will do, they will not invoice higher education except for the private provider's accreditation. So we will largely be a government-funded entity. And then there was a steady growth, except for last year when, with the Amendment Act, we have to adopt a new mandate area, which was standard setting. And a once-off payment of $9 million was transferred to the CHE to enable the organization to set up the necessary structures and to do the conceptual preparation and the frameworks for that new function. Now, that money was transferred only in the beginning of January. With that, our MTEF, that is the
3-year medium-term expenditure framework allocation was also slightly adjusted, and and this graph shows you what is our government grant over the next 3 years. The little green bar there just shows you the improvement. Currently, we will get the, let me first say that the budget that you will see in our business plan is not exactly the budget that I'm talking to, because of the $9 million that was injected, and also this adjustment of the MTEF. So the next financial year, starting on the 1st of April, we will have $1.5 million more than was initially allocated to the CHE. We have opted not to fundamentally review the budget, but we put that out on a competitive basis, and the bulk of that money would go to our advisory function, and that is to strengthen exactly the things that you were raising this morning, Chair. The way that we allocate or deploy our services, there we have, it's not exactly a copy of the organizational structure, but those are the core areas. The two slices that I've taken out there, the one with the 8%, this is the corporate services. This is mainly the cost associated with the council and its subcommittee meetings. Our council meets at least 4 times a year, and the executive committee 6 times, and they've got a whole range of subcommittees and working groups. And then it's also the office of the CEO. And then the 29%, that is the, if you wish, that would be the overheads of the organization, which we think in terms of a knowledge-based organization is quite under control. Then the others are for standard setting. That is the new one, the smallest one, and that will grow over time. Maybe not to the extent than the others, because once a quality has been set, then you don't necessarily need a huge infrastructure to maintain that. And most of the quality setting will be done outside of the CHE, but the CHE will obviously be the coordinating facility. Quality assurance, which still is the bulk of our activities, taking the form of accreditation of programs, quality promotion, and then the national reviews. And then the advice and the monitoring one, the 15%, and that section is, as I said, is likely to grow much faster than any of the other sections within the CHE. You'd like me to go back to that one?
Yes.
Yeah. Which one? Standard setting.
It's a mistake. It should be SS. Standard setting. My apologies.
I'm sorry. Why we use the ST is because we've got the double S for support services. Now we use the ST for it. Chair, this is to give you a feeling of how the organization's cost structure works. Currently, our personnel cost is 44%, and we expect that area to grow over the next 2 to 3 years so that it will more or less stabilize at 55 to 60%. We are looking for an organization with more, with a much bigger head and a much shorter tail, for exactly the same reasons that you have discussed with regard to higher education. We are also dearly in need of people of a high caliber, people who are very knowledgeable about higher education and how to advise appropriately. And then the 54% currently is for goods and services. We are not a very capital-intensive organization, apart from the IT and normal furniture, and then the newly acquired building, we've got no other assets, so most of our money goes into the staff. Then the gender profile of the organization, as it is, like the civil service, we are also dominated by female employees. In senior management, the senior management comprises the CEO, the chief financial officer, and the executive director responsible for quality assurance. And then we've got 4 directors in place, 3 directors, and shortly we will be appointing a director for standard setting as well. Then that is the other part. And finally, the race profile. I think we also have the same problem that at the higher education, the more senior you go, it's more difficult to find people. What is, I think, important for you to know is that in terms of our Act, the remuneration package of the chief executive officer has to be determined by the minister in consultation with the Minister of Finance. And a couple of years ago, the DPSA has established that that position should equal that of a DDG in the civil service. And this is why we have difficulty. We had difficulty in the past to find candidates. Normally, I think our council would assume that the typical CEO in the CHE would match the competencies and the qualifications of a deputy vice chancellor at the university. And there are not many universities that will pay their deputy vice chancellors on that level. So this is a serious concern, and then everybody will fit underneath, and this is why we have a problem trying to attract senior academics, particularly from the black community. But otherwise, we think it's a fairly good representation. Chair, what are you getting for the taxpayers' money? This is just an extraction from our performance indicators. We've got a list captured in our business plan, about 20 of them, and this is just a selection of them, the number of new programs to be assessed. Now, I just would like to draw your attention to that. The number of programs that we assessed is not, we do not initiate the process, we create the facility, it comes from the institutions themselves. So we estimate, based on past experience, that there could be as many as 100, and those go to various phases, and then number of accreditations to be completed, 130. Improvement plans to be analyzed. Now, this is improvement plans based on national reviews and or institutional audits. And as we've gone through the first cycle, that number will certainly drop, but it may increase in future again. The number of teach-out plans to be implemented, 11. And so forth. And then the number of... I think Dr. Stoop alluded to the fact that CHE will play an increasingly important role as an important disseminator of higher education information, so we intend to increase the number of copies that we do distribute to the 2,000. And then we've also increased the number of researchers, those are specialists on higher education, to 300 that we can call on to assist us with our projects. The advice to the minister, either from our side or required by the minister, is extremely difficult to predict in advance. But I, having listened to what has been discussed this morning and to Dr. Stumpf, one can anticipate that the format and the number of that advice could change quite significantly. It is not easy to quantify that kind of advice. Is it the number of memos that you submit to the minister, or is it the quality, or is it the number of pages? Is it the topics or the issues? That is something that we will have to resolve. Chair, in a nutshell, this is basically what I have to say about the operations. Any questions, I would be happy to be answered.
Thank you, Mr. Birkes. I'll allow three questions from my committee. Member Lafietro, Member Sadebe. That's final.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm very happy to listen to the presentation. It's quite enlightening, but I'm just a little bit concerned. I received this document today, and it's very enlightening. At the same time, I am afraid to ask you, give me your business card to make a follow-up if you had your contact details here on this piece of paper. That would serve the purpose, because what the professor has been saying, I wanted to do a follow-up. Lastly, Chair, I think also I must address the secretary of this committee on this matter, because he is the one who's doing preparation with the Council on Higher Education and other entities, that it would be advisable and ideal that the future people that are presented here must have those contact details, your physical address. That would help us a lot as members. The second question is, what are you doing regarding the the support that you have been talking about to the students? Support doesn't mean only the teachers and what have you. Support would mean giving free education to the student. I want to find out from you, as Council on Higher Education, if that is possible. Thank you.
Can I just advise members that we received the presentation not today, I think one. And secondly, it's on the addresses and the details are clearly on you, so I don't necessarily want you to respond. I'm neither the secretary to the committee, so I would want to suggest Member Lachet should just reflect on the document. Can we then move to Member Khadir?
Thanks, Chair. If we could be able to just open in your gender profile slide there. Something that I just wanted to reflect in the what I wanted just to appreciate is that you have there's a show of many reflection of recognition of women, but when you go to your race profile, it doesn't reflect same as you know you expect, you know, to respond, and you know my expectation was to say if your gender profile will just reflect that you do have, you know, people on the senior management, and we're able to just to see them here, unless they are here, just that they are not next to you. Because I just see the Matota profile in front of me, but the reflection that is there is not feasible. You know, you sometimes when you present something, you must also have a support system next to you. But when you say you've got female representation that are also there, but I let not next to you, well, it just tells that, you know, it's a covering face. They are not there. But also, if you can just go to your race profile as well. I understand that you also said maybe you had challenges in terms of recruiting black professionals. My question was to say, what strategies that are you trying to implement at the current phase to ensure that at least you recruit more and you reflect, you know, what you want to reflect in terms of your race and gender balance, in terms of your craft there. What strategies are you coming with so that you also mitigate and respond positively, so that, you know, we don't face up with the very same problem? Because we are not expecting that next time when you come back to us, we'll be asking you, are you still presenting the very same thing? And then if you didn't come up with any strategies, you didn't come up with the mitigation plans, then what? You see, we're not doing anything. We're just presenting this thing. So, and the committee will just take this thing and end it there. So that at least we'll be able to get a sense that at least you having a very serious concern about the reflection of this, and you're going to act with it, so that at least you can give us a time period to say, when next time you come to present to this committee, there will be at least a change of some sort, a response towards, you know, the 50-50 balance.
Point made. Can we just get sharp responses on two issues? The one is the demographics and the other one is obviously the gender. And in the free education discussion, we will be getting a presentation from the review body in this meeting.
So I don't want to respond to that. Chair, as far as the female representation, we obviously were trying to bring one of our senior female members with us, but it was due to the time notice simply not possible. We do not have necessarily specific targets in terms of the number of females or males that we do employ, but we do have in the process of developing is a succession planning, Chair, which will clearly set the targets. For instance, we are creating now a position for a human resources manager within the organization, and that position has clearly been targeted to be filled by a black person. Next time when I sit here, that position is either filled by a black person or it's not filled. And the same would apply to a manager in the procurement department of support services. Within the mandatory areas, it is a little bit more difficult to achieve the same targets because we can recruit from the entire country. We don't necessarily look for an HR manager with prior exposure to a higher education institution or for a procurement officer. But when you're talking about quality assurance or when you're talking about national reviews or standard setting, you obviously are looking at a much narrower market. And that's more difficult. We are then competing with higher education and we are competing with many other institutions. And that makes setting a target or achieving the target extremely, extremely difficult. We may set the target, but achieving it is completely a different matter.
Can we thank Professor Stumpf and Sibiakis for their presentations? As I've indicated earlier, that this is the type of interventions. It was actually not on the initial presentation, but precisely after being triggered to respond, it is the type of interventions that we are looking for. And therefore, I think there was a advice by one of our members that says, if you are there for that in that transition period, it's important to take this information also to the new, whatever that new is. What I would suggest is that we get from you two further information sheets. The one is just the perspective, any information that you've got on higher education in the context of a developmental state, whatever you've worked on in the past, is there a perspective of it from Council for Higher Education? Is there not? If there is one, what is it? And if you can just put that for us, bring it, send it forward. If we can have it by Monday morning through the secretary of our committee. The second one is, what is the battle plan for the interventions? As the advice that you've been given over many years, or the analysis that you've had to do over many years, you've alluded to some of the interventions that you'll be suggesting. Can you put that in form for us? It's really just, as we are moving to the bigger plans and the long-term 30 years programs, there is a now. And what, therefore, is the interventions in the now, in 2010, 2011, 2012, that you would advise us to, in fact, reflect? If we can also have, you've actually raised some of that, it's not the totality of it, so it's not in a thesis, it is really just that sort of thing, a bullet point document. If you can also send that to us by Monday morning, that will help. For that, members, I would want to suggest that we just stretch for 3 minutes and then come back and just be around. So we'll call you immediately back and thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
back couple of coffee shops this morning. You did say
that. Definitely. No, what is that? Can we move to our second item on this agenda? And Minister, welcome. We had a quite refreshing input from the Council for Higher Education earlier. Also, we've been joined by the student organizations, and we will still go into a normal process of the NSFAS strategic plan, but I think it is possibly of relevance now just to start on my left, and if we just introduce ourselves very quickly and just really, you don't say where you're coming from, but the organizations. Members of our committee, you can just indicate who you are as MPs, and then, because there are a few guests that we've invited as well. Starting on my left. So I'm Maris Fransman, Sherry.
I'm Manele, the Secretary of the Committee.
Mamuluko Kansani Kubai, Member of the Committee.
George Binamu, Member of the Committee.
Lekheto, Member of the Committee.
Nolita Vukuza, Member of the Committee.
Namalunge Lugina, Member of the Committee.
Suso Karebe, Member of the Committee.
Mfiki Makazi, Member of
Committee.
Ashley Ndantumayo, Chief Operations Officer, NSFAS.
Ashley Seymour, CEO of NSFAS.
Mofis, Chief Financial Officer, NSFAS.
Connie Feldman, Communications, NSFAS.
Stephen Smith, Chairman, NSFAS Audit Committee.
Mbulelo Mandla, President of SARCO, SARCO Students Commerce.
Mbali Sope, Secretary General, South.
Sandile Phakathi, President, South African Union of Students.
Lazo Landamase, Secretary General of SASCO.
Lokthula Ngapa, Parliamentary Liaison Officer from the Minister of Higher Education and Training. Thanks.
John Pampalis, Advisor to the Minister.
Liesl Peifert, a member of the media from De Burger.
Ranjini Munsami, Ministry.
Omar James, member of the committee.
Dennis Bandi, Content Advisor for the Portfolio Committee.
Mampao Mudiba, Researcher for Committee.
Nabat Mandela, Chief of Staff Ministry.
Mary Metcalf, DG Higher Education and Training.
Kirsty Menon, Acting Deputy Director General, Universities.
Please, Ndumande, Bafana Bafana.
Thank you, Bafana Bafana. Member?
I'm Paul John, a member of the committee from the kingdom. Thank you.
Good. Minister, just by virtue of introduction, we've, over the last, I think, 2-3 weeks, had to deal with the strat plan, the budget in preparation to the budget vote that will happen next week. We indicated last week that it is a new realigned department, obviously a department there for that. We'll have still to develop quite a lot of technical details. We've reiterated last week that the CETA landscape has only joined as of the 1st of November in its functions, not necessarily in its monetary accountability. And hence, that there is an appreciation of the alignment processes and the trajectory over 30 years, and more that 20 to 30 years vision that the department has spelled out in its strategic plan. We, however, did indicate, and it's in a sense a little bit of a, we've indicated that whilst we are looking at the broader issues, that there are ministerial pronouncements, that there's presidential pronouncements, and that some of those things we, in fact, need to reflect in the strat plan. So I'm raising this because that was an issue that we've picked up last week. So that there's alignment between the policy positioning and then the actual budgeting and the strategic plan process. And it's literally moving from what was in the past into the new, and how do we manage that particular transition, which is obviously a very, very tough process. One of those transitional processes was initiated, I think, middle last year by yourself, on the back of the resolutions at Polokwane through the NISFAS review, and the pronouncements made in this regard. Also would want to say that it was of interest last night in a national debate on Afrikaans that I've picked up that one of the, I think it's Professor Thielof, indicating, and I can quote it directly, that transformation is not a constitutional imperative. And at some stage, I think we need to debate that issue, because I always thought that transformation runs through the very veins of a constitution and our constitutional democracy. Now, it is fine if a community activist or person on the ground actually raise that issue. It is not acceptable where one would sit if the head of institutions are really fundamentally having that particular perspective, because it then asks the question, in what way is the implementation and the activation of transformation being seen through by its very managers at some of those institutions? I'm raising that because it was not a private engagement, it was a public one. If it was private, obviously it wouldn't have come to the attention of the community or the public. So I think there are very much challenges. You've last year also pronounced yourself on the social, on the transformation and cohesion report issues. We've picked up, I think it was possibly 3 weeks ago that we had a meeting with the department, that at that time, your initial instruction for end of January, feedback from those institutions, after an extension of a deadline until the end of February, at that particular time, beginning of March, when we were debating this, the department only received, I think, at that time, roughly seven of the responses out of 23. What was strange is that some of the institutions that were in the public domain relating to transformation questions and social disintegration issues were not featured in terms of the submissions. I hope it is now different. So I think there's critical issues, and our committee would want you to then lead us into the discussion around the NSFAS review process. Minister.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Honorable members, invited guests, colleagues and comrades, thank you very much for this invitation. Bonjani, you know, the last time I was in a portfolio committee meeting here is when you walked out, by the way, against the National Education Policy Act. I was sitting in the chair's position, 1995. So it's good to be back here. I hope I won't be haunted by those books. That's just by the way, you know, we've always been teasing each other. Just to thank the committee for this opportunity. In fact, I'd like to say, Chair, you know, that had we had all the time, I would really like to make it a habit that on key issues, now and again, I come and share with the committee and engage, debate and so on, because we are all in this together, much as you have the role of being oversight at the same time. Maybe just before I go into the bioscope there, I just need to clarify just on some of your remarks, by the way, that we have submitted the strat plans of all the 23 sitters. They were tabled on the 2nd together with our strat plan.
I referred to the submissions on your responses, the responses that you were waiting from higher education institutions.
Okay. All right.
That is what I was referring to.
Well, I was going to come to that as well, because we have a meeting that is scheduled with the chairpersons of councils on the 13th of April. Precisely, amongst other things, to discuss this particular question. And you are also aware, Chair, that we have a higher education summit on the 22nd and 23rd of April. And if I'm not mistaken, we've extended an invitation to the portfolio committee. Which would yet be also another platform to further discuss these issues that we are raising. But just by way of update, we now have responses from 16 universities. We want to actually raise this matter with the others. We've followed up. Let me take you through the report of the review committee of the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, which we released yesterday, which unfortunately was leaked beforehand to the independent group of newspapers, and we had expressed our serious displeasure at that, and it's something that we're going to be following up as to how that report landed in the hands of the media before we formally release it. Perhaps before I go into the structure of this presentation, I need to make it clear what I'm doing today and what I'm not doing. Basically, what I'm presenting today is not a response of the department to the findings or the recommendations of the review committee. It's to just present to you what are the key observations, findings, and recommendations. But what I will cover a little bit are some of the things that we have started acting upon already, which were fairly straightforward and clear that they actually do need to be acted upon, but not the substance of the recommendations. So the structure of the presentation, quickly, Chair and Honourable Members, is that just to remind ourselves, why was there a review of NSFAS, the key findings, the recommendations, the challenges, and as I have said, how are we dealing with this? On why a review of NSFAS, I'm sure you're aware of this, is just by way of refreshing our memories. Some of the factors that informed this was the fact that administrative capacity of NSFAS had not kept pace with growth in size of the fund, which has grown tenfold between 1999 and 2010. In fact, now in the new financial year, it's going to be at 2.7 billion. And also, because of concerns regarding the growing numbers of blacklisted borrowers, and also the need to assess short, medium, and long-term growth requirements of the fund to increase access, particularly to poor students, and the need to review the distribution and allocation processes. But also, what was critical was that the review was necessary in order to begin to respond to the one of the resolutions of the ruling party, its manifesto, about commitment to providing progressively free education up to at least undergraduate level for poor students. Now, just in terms of the process as we move forward from now, we presented an executive summary of this report to Cabinet on the 24th of February. Because we thought that before we release this publicly, it was important that Cabinet is aware of what is contained in the report, which we released yesterday. As I have said, I will cover this in terms of some urgent work that we have identified arising out of the report, which needs to be undertaken as we at the same time then receive comments through a public participation process. We can't prescribe for the committee, but it would really be ideal if you have space and time, Chairperson, for the committee to also maybe receive some oral responses so that also there is engagement at that level. I think that it would be important, maybe through invited stakeholders. But it's just something that on our side we think it would be good if your schedule permits. It will deepen the discussions and the debate around this report. We intend, as you are aware, we've actually allowed public comment until the end of April, a period of about 6 weeks. Of course, under ideal circumstances, we would have preferred that we have a longer period. But time is against us, because we will then have to, from between May and August, prepare our own response and submit recommendations to Cabinet, so that whatever new measures may be taken arising out of what Cabinet may decide are things that we can begin to implement next year, at the beginning of next year. So that is what necessitates that we give only 6 weeks, and hoping that stakeholders will be able to respond so that by end of August we're at Cabinet. Now, just on the current situation, the key facts which emerge from the report about NSFAS. 17% of higher education students receive NSFAS funds unevenly distributed across higher education institutions, and allocations are on the basis of the ratio of disadvantaged students. The upper limit of family income in order to qualify for NSFAS is 122,000 rands per annum. And not all universities allocate funds. In fact, none of the universities allocate funds sufficient to cover the full cost of study. We'll return to this matter just now. As a result of that, student debt now at higher education institutions, which is caused by the shortfall between what NSFAS, well, for NSFAS students, it's not only for NSFAS students. There are other students who do not qualify, who have got their own
who are unable to pay all the amounts. But for... So student debt is, at the moment is in excess of 2 billion rands. It's a very serious matter. In addition to the loan book, this is just outside the loan book, NSFAS. There are 256,258 borrowers on NSFAS books, of which 153,596 are still studying. 2009, 33% of NSFAS students were still registered students. just 125,000 who had graduated from the 200 from the total number, and 316,000 had dropped out without completing their studies. That's a staggering 48%. Loan recovery rate is 20 to 26%, which is also quite low. And the amount, as I've said, of NSFAS funding in terms of now the key findings of the report, it falls far short of the demand, and there are significant gaps, as I have said, between the NSFAS award and the full cost of study for many students. I don't know, Kerti, whether you want just to move to the table of the allocation formula quickly. It's just 2 pages ahead. Just to give the committee an idea of what we are talking about, just a sample. This information is in your reports. If you take UCT, for instance, the full cost of study at UCT is 54,000 rand. But the average NSFAS award is about 21,000. You take Forte, the full cost of study at Forte is 32,000, but the average NSFAS award is 10,000, and so on. To Walter Sisulu. Maybe if you go back then to the key findings, the first on allocations. So that is the picture. The other finding, of course, is that there are many families who cannot afford higher education, but whose income is above the threshold of 122,000. That's the missing middle. Now, just a bit on this missing middle. It actually affects what one would call the core of the working class in this country. For instance, in the public service, you are talking of teachers, nurses, police, and so on. They also, by the way, are the missing middle also in terms of housing, because they don't qualify for what we call the RDP houses, yet the banks won't look at them if they want bonds. Just like here, the banks would not look at them if they want money for their kids. Hence, incidentally, in my other life, I was playing the role of confronting the credit bureaus. This explains why this core of the working class is heavily indebted. And it's a serious political matter. The other finding from the report is that the disadvantaged student index used to allocate funds to institutions focuses on race to the exclusion of class, although the individual awards are actually based on class. Moving on then, I have spoken to this table, just continuing with the key findings. NSFAS Act, for instance, gives extra to judicial garnishing powers. This is a matter that we are acting on as one of those urgent matters, because this affects 8,344 borrowers. Because NSFAS, unfortunately, and that's not a negative comment on the hard work that NSFAS has been doing and continues to do, very good work in many instances. But some of these garnishee orders are at variance with the law, especially the National Credit Act. And also, loans prior to NSFAS have mostly prescribed and are legally unenforceable, but they still remain, unfortunately, on the loan book. And the loan book is currently 350% of the value of the combined original loan. Now, that's another matter that is serious, because, by the way, the law does not allow anyone to charge interest more than the original loan that was given. The committee has made findings here, observations. They, for instance, came across examples where a student was given 3,000 rand but is owing 16,000 rand because of non-payment over a period of time. So the loan book is being reviewed in terms of the National Credit Act, and it's clear that its value will be reduced according to the key findings of this committee. Now, on expanding access, we just want to share with you DJ, this table in terms of if we are really coming to the nub of the matter, is that projections, if we then want to achieve what SASCO was marching about in my absence, it looks like this, that if we use current figures for 2010, at the moment the participation rate of the relevant age group, 18 to 24, it's 17%, and if we estimate now that the percentage of poor or students from poor or working class backgrounds would be participating at 14% in higher education, we need 5.2 billion rand to cover everyone in that category. And if you were to increase the participation rate of poor and working class students to 25% of the total, it would require 9.2 billion. And so on. If it's 40%, it's 14.8 billion rand. And that would, of course, be increasing, if you look on your left there, the overall participation rate, by increasing the participation rate of students from poor and working class background. It's very important to actually note this matter, because, frankly, one of the issues that we will have to grapple with is how much of a bid, when we make our recommendations, we take them to cabinet, how much of a bid can we hope to get on top of two universities that we want to build in Mpumalanga and Northern Cape, and on top of redress, serious redress in terms of your... I said to someone yesterday, former black university, said to me, no, currently black universities, because they are still black. Ungowe, Babumbonjan, Limpopo, and so on. Venda, etc., etc. Now, this poses the question to all of us as to Because in one way or the other, in considering this, we have to together also think about prioritization and issues of phasing in. Again, if you look at this table, this is now an estimate in terms of FET colleges. As you know, one of the key mandates of our department is actually to expand the college sector quite significantly in order to correct this anomaly that we have got a bigger university system than the college system. We are the only country in the world that has got that. Those are just your estimates that, for instance, if you increase just funding FET college students, those who are just doing the national certificate vocational, at 2.4% enrollment rate, we are looking at 4.23 billion just for your FET colleges. Now, some of the other key findings. Now, in this instance, specifically on administration and governance, is that there is a need for strong governance, and we do need a capacity and skills audit for NSFAS, and also to strengthen loan administration at institutional levels, that is, at universities and colleges. As well as strengthening financial aid offices, that's what the committee is saying, and the development of competency for loan administration and bursary, as well as to strengthen the FET bursary award system. When I say these things, we need to remind ourselves that, you know, TEFSA, the predecessor to NSFAS, really was more or less like an NGO-type thing, you know, starting small. Now, 2.7 billion, it's a serious operation. And frankly, we have not grown the capacity that is needed in NSFAS in order to be able to handle these amounts of money, which is what we need to do. So some of the weaknesses largely just arise out of that. The scheme has really grown big. Now, the other key recommendation, therefore, from the committee is on this issue of expanding access. I'm glad also the student organizations are here. Because what we need, one of our challenges is that we actually do need a comprehensive policy framework to articulate the details of the national policy imperative of providing free higher and further education progressively with a focus on the poor. It's not just a mathematical or a question of rents and cents and putting more money into NSFAS. It's not only that, but we do actually need a policy. For example, one of the issues that we have got to deal with, should we be saying, if we say we want to progressively provide free, what happens if in one institution we are actually producing 90% social science students, for example? How do we, within this context, also factor our priorities on skills, for instance, areas of scarce skills and other areas? It's quite a complex thing because also to a large extent we are dealing with what is coming out of the school system. I mean, I went to University of Zululand now during the registration period and I found that more than 60% of the students who were registering are actually doing education. And I was saying to myself, wow, aren't we breeding another round of oversupply of teachers in particular fields? So all these issues are going to be very critical, that when we actually look at this issue of access, we do need a policy framework so that we don't have a hit and miss. Chairperson. I hope I'm making sense. Recommendations on allocations is that the committee recommends that we move from race-based to class-based allocation formula. And a key recommendation also is that all institutions should receive the average full cost of study per student, regardless of the institutionally determined cost of study. If you just recall that other slide, if you just read it on the right-hand side, you find that UCT charges 56,000 rands per annum. And which one is the lowest water for school? Which is at what? 25,000. So there is a huge difference amongst institutions themselves. And the committee has calculated that if you then come up with an average figure of how much does it cost to be at university in South Africa today, the average is 43,000 rand. Now, the committee is actually suggesting that we give that to each and every student, the 43,000. And also what it is suggesting is that students must carry their money to the institution where they are taken, not literally, not in black bags either. We... go and ask Cope. I'm sorry, sis. My apologies. Protect me, Chair, from Ubab Mbonja.
The minister put it in his foot into that. No, that's what I'm saying.
Completely the suggestion of the committee in this, because it's an important issue that we all have to engage with, is that a student can choose to go to any university knowing that he or she is having 43,000. But it's not money that gets given to the student. So if the student has 43,000 and goes to Walter Sisulu to pay 25,000, the difference, the change doesn't come. No, no. The change doesn't come to the student. The change remains with the institution. And government will have to give guidelines, the department, of what that money can be used for. Whether it's residences and teaching and learning, improving those things and so on. So the students' leadership here mustn't start getting excited about change. If this recommendation is accepted, it's not yet. And that also students who are qualifying within that context, of course, is aiming to try and give the full cost of study. On the loan book, the committee has recommended that there must be compliance with the National Credit Act. That's obvious. And also suggests that that loan book must be audited, which is now part of our immediate action. And that we are also soliciting further legal opinion about NSFAS practices, whether they are compliant with the Constitution and the National Credit Act. We are also establishing a task team immediately to review the cost implications of incremental rollout of fully subsidized undergraduate education for the financially needy, and a working group to assess the feasibility of increasing, as the committee is recommending, FET bursary from 80% to 100%. We think these things, irrespective of our response to the major recommendations, they need to be done. These kinds of processes that we are undertaking now already. On administration and governance, an HR expert from our department is advising on possible restructuring and policies of NSFAS, close monitoring of progress of governance review commissioned by NSFAS itself, and also we are currently considering appointing a turnaround team to improve administration in line with the recommendations. There is a new CEO now who is here, has to be at the head of that task. Also, we will need, what we are already doing now is simplifying the means test and ensuring that it must, whatever it is in the end, it must uniformly apply at all institutions. And the view, and this we feel must be done. You can't just be tampering with NSFAS or even giving NSFAS more money without looking at the same time the funding formula for our education institutions and the link to the rising cost of study at institutions. Because we don't want a situation, say, where we to decide that government, where government to decide to give more money to NSFAS and something close to full cost of study, then universities start raising fees sharply. And they see that as a source of further funding. That is why this is going to be, as we look at NSFAS, we are also this year as the department looking at the funding formula for universities. It's not only determined by the fact that we have a NSFAS review. There are also other considerations and misalignments that are there in terms of the funding formula. The task team also that is looking into these immediate actions, the work that is underway, will also engage SARS on the possibility of loan recovery and the solution for the missing middle. As I have said, children of public servants earning between 122,000 and 300,000. That's what the committee is saying. Who are members of the Government Employees Pension Fund, we should look at what are the possibilities of using some of the resources in that fund for public servants' children to be able to get affordable loans. That means engaging the PIC in order to be able to do this. Chairperson, that's the nub of what this report is saying. And as I have said, as I end, I don't think that we are in a position to be questioned about what we think about the recommendations, because we are not yet there. We are not yet there.
Minister is protected in this.
Yes, please. Uba Mponjane, maybe you should move him to go and sit there next to Sasko. Is Sadesmo here as well? Oh, okay. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Minister. Members of the committee, I think we've got the report. Minister, I think it was quite comprehensive, giving just a synopsis. I think there is a recommendation that says there will now be public engagement and there's a deadline for August. I must admit that the very last point on that slide actually started to say, how do we re-engineer state resources in the context of needs of society? So I think it's an important debate. Obviously quite interesting. It will open up quite a few engagements, only that point in itself, but it's a necessary one. What we will get later, a report from NSFAS. We've also picked up the turnaround suggestion, and one of the things, Minister, that's going to be critical is that alignment between the immediate, because there's obvious things to happen, as you correctly say, and its implementation in the strat plan and financial year, so that we don't miss, hence, the deadline on some of those matters, even though the review report only arrived over the last few days. There is, in the report findings, one picks up certain assumptions, and one of that is in relation to the current, the projected 5.2 billion if so many students. It would be very interesting to understand the bloated or not so bloated cost drivers in education in its current context. Differently put, can it be more affordable even in the existing envelope in terms of the way, for example, the cost drivers at services at education level that we are picking up? We've picked up some of that at FET college level, and we can see some discrepancies at that. I didn't really go into the university level yet on that particular one. What I will allow before we engage is possibly request South to just because they did raise 3 weeks ago, and we've invited them here. And then just to put some of the perspectives that they felt as a coordinating student body to raise. And then we'll allow our members to engage on this particular matter. Sas, the General Secretary?
Thanks very much, Chair. I first and foremost want to appreciate the opportunity of being here and welcome the presentation by the Minister as well. Well, our own view as South, first and foremost, is that we feel that the summary of the report, as the Minister has presented it, captures some of the contextual issues that we have always been raising. But we also feel at the same time, maybe if I can start with the positives, that it does cover the socio-economic problems, especially around the three categories of students, those that ordinarily would have qualified for NSFAS, and those that do not qualify as the basis of their household annual income, being slightly higher than the means test as stipulated by NSFAS. And those that can also be able to pay for higher education, but to whom the higher education system in South Africa may not be attractive enough and therefore opting out of the higher education in South Africa. So you find that some of the money that or the funds that can be injected into higher education in South Africa end up having been invested somewhere else outside the country because to some of them, because of their own class backgrounds, do not find the higher education in South Africa to be attractive, but also given some of the cultural and political reasons that other people may choose to leave the country. That is the one. But the second one also being that it captures the challenges facing the FET sector and the fact that many students in the FET sector, even those that are beneficiaries of NSFAS, still continue to face challenges in the manner in which it is administered in individual colleges. Because there isn't, even though in written form, there is a policy guiding how NSFAS must be distributed, but in actual practice, per institution, there still are challenges with regard to that. I think I have, in the recent past, been communicating with Mr. Konde with regard to that, some of the issues that may need immediate attention. But I am very much in agreement with the general observations and the recommendations. But some of the issues that seem to be left out is how do we make sure that parallel to us trying to expand access and bring all these other interventions, we practicalize the level to which you can be able, I do not use the word compel, but regulate the capping of fees in institutions. Because as the Minister has rightly observed, there are areas or there are tendencies of increasing fees as a culture, not necessarily because there is a necessity. And those increase in fees do not match the expansion or lack thereof in infrastructure, the physical infrastructure in the universities, regardless of the fact that enrollment patterns have changed drastically since 1994. And the fact that other institutions still regard housing and accommodation as not their core function, their core function being teaching, learning, and research. So those are some of the areas, Chair. But in terms of the other temptation that may be there with universities is that if indeed there is such an openness and us wanting to provide progressively provide free education, higher education, there is going to be an argument coming through that says let us, as those universities that have been charging less, start to equalize fees. Equalizing fees in two forms. The one form is within institutions themselves. Those courses that are charged less are going to be increased. And amongst institutions now competing with one another, those that are charging lower are going to want to charge more because government has expressed an openness to the option or the possibility of providing free higher education. And I think it's the role of all of us then to see how we can come together to make sure that there is some regulatory form through which we can be able to manage this. The one that I think is not covered is okay. In part, it is perfect. Where through you, Chair, was talking about the provision of what in South we called the voucher system, but we also talked about the voucher system with regard to matriculants as they apply for admission for entry in universities. So we said that a matriculant in the Eastern Cape, in Limpopo, in Gauteng, when they apply to any university for entry, within the application forms, there must be an NSFAS form which independently is going to determine whether or not the student does qualify for funding because of the documentation that would have been provided. That would avoid two things. Where students of those that are slightly above the 122,000 come to us because really they do need, but they do not meet the policy requirements. And you find that there's a lot of fraudulent practices that happen even among students from backgrounds of parents who can afford to pay that say to us, can you assist me put together an affidavit? I've got my grandmother's pension fund payment slip. But if that comes from matriculants applying genuinely with information from their parents, immediate parents, it would be curbed a bit. Where we said that voucher, NSFAS must send it to the student so that whether the student is admitted in Rhodes or in Limpopo or in WSU, that voucher carries with the student because already the student qualifies for funding regardless of the cost of study in the university. But I think the report as the minister presents it does cover it in part, even though not explicitly, as I put it. I think I'll have to rest it there, Chair.
I'm just going to allow another person from South, and then I will allow the members.
Thank you, Chair. We must first appreciate the opportunity that we are given to sit and talk to this committee. As an affiliate organization to South, SASCO, we need to put a few words across about our observations and opinions about the report and the discussion of centered around the recommendations and the free education topic. Because, as the minister says, our take as an organization is that moving forward from the recommendations of the report, we ought to move to a situation that speaks of a systematic reconfiguration of the funding regime of higher education in South Africa, both at the level of funding individual student cost of study and the funding of the universities in general to operate. It does mention in the report that that issue has got to be addressed. It is more so urgent, the issue, because
As far as we're concerned in SASCO, the South African higher education has not, ever since the transition to democracy for that matter, really sat down and thought and spoke at a strategic level about how do we reorganize the higher education cake to balance the situations that are extremely undesirable of variations and the extent and the strength of each university in comparison to the next. And I think that particular question also informs part of the challenges that we have at the policy level that relate to articulation of courses, relate to the strength of and the recognition that one qualification from one university has in relation to the next, in comparison rather to the next, and so on. Just listening to speech, it comes to mind that that reconfiguration has got to achieve some of those objectives that relate to that systematic change situation. Secondly, we have not obviously studied the report, given that it was out yesterday. We might just have read it, but we have not studied it. Just probably the ministry has studied it because they had it on the 24th of February and so on. But there are very glaring issues that come out for us. The first issue is the pronunciation and the principal commitment to the notion of provision of free higher education to undergraduate level. It's profound and historic because this is a process that has been established by mandate of government, constituted by people who are appointed by government, and as far as being a government institution for all intents and purposes. That process starts and takes you to a recommendation that acknowledges, which we have not done in South Africa for quite a while, the basic character of higher education in South Africa, or at least undergraduate qualifications. Because there's always an acknowledgement that our economy and society has moved now from what it used to be into being a knowledge-based economy. That being the case, therefore, means that key among other things, you need a population whose knowledge on certain areas that are critical areas and focus areas of growth in our economy. You require then a contingent of young people that are efficiently produced in a system that does not give them headaches around whether or not they might be lucky to get at least a 50% funding of NFAS and so on. So that's the first issue. It also vindicates those of us who have been arguing for a while that the problem in South African higher education is also and mainly about the money. The question of access is mainly about the money. The question of success is mainly about the money. Because if you go to Walter Sisulu University today, they will tell you the reason why they are students of BSc chemistry have got to suffer and share facilities in relation to their lab and all related issues is related to the fact that they are unable from their own coffers to expand that particular capacity. It may not be the case in Stellenbosch. So therefore, the success rate will definitely be different from one university to the next. And there is no, there cannot be an argument to say that problem is unrelated to the money. And we're saying that that report from that perspective at least acknowledges and accepts that the financial strength of the university determines. And I do think that this report has got to really take us somewhere on this aspect. Determines the extent of the success of the student body on those matters.
And all the people who have spoken against this position say it is not about the money. It actually is about the money. And lastly, Tim, in a movement forward, we think that what ought to be our course of action now is not to debate how not to realize the recommendations of the report. What we ought to do is to say, given the legitimacy and the correct premise of the report and its finding and its recommendations, and in their relationship with the strategic question of the addressing the skills question and the education question in general in South Africa, how to utilize that particular important finding as a basis and a springboard for us to say, we do not only relook and reconfigure how we look at our education budget, but we must do so within the total fiscus of the country. Because for me, I think education has not been located at the center, and many people have argued this, at the center of the national agenda of the country, appreciating the National Higher Education Summit as an initial step to reconcile that issue. I know of no country in my limited studying process. I know of no country who is now positioned in terms of being a developing economy that has paid little attention, both in terms of budget and policy, as we have in South Africa. This report actually opens an opportunity for us to really backtrack. Not physically, backtrack and say that these are the gaps. This is how we lost the white paper discussion. This is how we lost the mergers discussion. This is how we lost the discussion about system and linking of higher education training and the schooling system. This is how we have lost the monitoring system around the price of education in South Africa, which has become ridiculously high in comparison to countries in our position in the world. And then say, this is how we speak about that issue, Comrade Minister, within the total fiscus and the national agenda for our country. And we say this in full realization of the billions that you have just mentioned there. And those billions don't scare us, and they should not. They should not, because it is natural that such an important agenda has got to cost you something.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That was the perspective from our students, also dealing with the issues that they've raised in the absence of the minister. They didn't say everything, though, Minister. They said outside. Back to our members, James.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the minister's presentation and remarks. I think this is a watershed moment in our history, because we're talking about something that's quite fundamental to the future of the country, which is to enlarge our higher education population in the country, which we require to do in principle, but also because it's central to our development into the future. So I want to make just five or six very quick points of principle rather than speak about the details, to honor the minister's request not to interrogate him on the detail. The first is that this is about, in the first instance, a question of choice for students, and a question of creating opportunities for students. That is what the effect of the new policy guidelines around student financial aid would have to deal with. It's about choice for students. It's not about creating bureaucracies. It's about maximizing choice for students, which means that most of the money must get into the students' hands. That's the first point. The second is that is to say that we are talking about state-supported education for people who cannot afford it, We're not speaking about free education. Actually, that's a misnomer. There is no such a thing as free education because somebody always has to pay. And what we are endorsing, and I'm endorsing it now too, as a member of this committee, is the principle of state-supported education for South Africans who cannot afford entry but who have the talent to enter university or college. It's a fundamental principle. Which we endorse, and the party I represent also endorses that. But it's not free education, because it's taxpayers' money that's being used to fund students who cannot afford it. And it's a very, very important thing that we must do. So to say that is 100%, more than 100% support for that principle. The third is that we are talking about colleges and universities. We always say that, you know, FET colleges are important. And then we end up speaking about universities. This thing of, in our country, acknowledging the importance of the college sector rhetorically and then shifting the debate to universities. We should actually stop that. We should focus on those colleges. They ought to become highly attractive avenues of further education, and they are presently not. In the minds of students, they're not. They're seen as second rate. In the minds of parents, they are not seen that way. They're also seen as second rate. And even within the government sector, there is this idea that the only worthwhile thing to do is to get a university degree. It actually is not true. If you go to Switzerland, it's extremely worthwhile to be trained as a watchmaker. It has high status. They also earn a good salary. Okay. So I just want to make the point that we must be careful to look at the entire higher education sector and not simply focus on universities. And in fact, if there's one thing this administration, this government can do is, in fact, enhance the college sector, because the universities are okay. They just need tweaking. But the colleges need to be built up because they are in trouble. And we know that. The third is that instead of, and this is a principle, I think we should have a progressive sliding scale in terms of state support. Students who cannot afford it should get a full bursary. Students who can get a contribution from their family should get a partial bursary. That's going to be a difference in terms of our approach. But I think it's important to say now that we would support the principle of a progressive scale, a sliding scale in terms of distribution. A further principle is that in order to enhance student choice, I think there must be an opportunity for students to directly access NSFAS bursary money and not go through universities. There has to be a direct access. If on top of the existing system, one awards, makes an award to students, that they would then go around universities, essentially go on a shopping spree to find the best match for their interests. And then once they're admitted by the university, clearly the money would go across. The money, as the minister would say, it won't go into the student's pocket. But that free access would inject some competition as well in the system. So universities would start bidding for students. And, in fact, it will drive that cost driver that the chair referred to down, one would hope. So that is an important principle. A further principle, which I think would be a difference of view here, is that we believe that universities and colleges should be self-governing, in fact, and that they should set their own fees and that they should, in fact, pay their own salaries and that they should be allowed to do that. And so there should be no capping or government regulation on those two key questions. The best universities in the world tend to operate that way. And if you want to improve the Department of Agriculture at the University of Fort Hare, just offer double the salaries that you presently offer and attract the best person to come as a professor or a doctor or a senior lecturer to teach. The students will come. The research contracts would increase in terms of the attractiveness, because what you do is you actually provide that university with the resources to attract the best people in the world who can teach the students. And so I think universities should be self. If you look at medical schools, you can see also that if you want Walter Sisulu's medical school to improve, what you do is you make it possible for that university to pay the best salaries to attract the best medical clinicians and teachers that person will attract your graduate students. That person will attract the research contracts from the Medical Research Council. And so the quality of medical education at Walter Sisulu University will improve. You don't do that by flattening the wage scales. You don't do that by telling universities what kind of fees they ought to charge and what kind of salaries they ought to pay. Introduce a measure of competition into the system. I have two other points that are detailed points around what is in the recommendations of the report to do with the role of the minister in relation to that. We should speak about that on another occasion. I think it's highly problematic. I don't think the minister should have the power to recall members of the board. I think that's not right. But I think that's clearly a discussion for some other time. And my final point is that we don't think that there's any reason to not include private providers, higher education providers, in the state subsidy scheme. If there's a good degree being offered by a private provider that's accredited by the government, why not invest in it? Why not allow a private provider to expand its offerings? Because the students will clearly benefit from that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's get other members then to input. Emma Bukuza.
Thank you, Chair. A few ones from me. One is the... Well, thank you, Minister, for the presentation. I'd like to raise, though, before I get into content, a process issue, and I'm sure maybe I'm right or I'm wrong, but I'm putting it out there to you, Minister, that I was kind of taken aback when I saw the Minister or the Ministry presenting the report to the public. I was really of the mind that probably we would have been your first port of call, but of course that's just my sentiment. I would have really wanted to have been privy to what you were telling the public, being the portfolio committee, so that I could feel quite confident about my role here in terms of supporting you. That's number one. Number two is the issue of the NSFAS putting it in the middle of the discourse, you know, in society and in the nation. That, for me, this whole issue of 2.8, if that is the right figure, of the youth who are neither at school, disabled, or employed, if that is the right figure, I think that somebody must really research and tell us that amount, because it keeps on vacillating. Because for me, that's a reproductive cycle of poverty and unemployment. Because if this youth, then they get to a point of getting to have children, then they won't be able to put them to school. So there is no change agent that is going to break the cycle of poverty and unemployment. And so I want to put NSFAS somewhere where I think that it's one of the tools for the nation that would break away, or that would break the chain of poverty and unemployment, I think, when used adequately. And I think I concur with one of my learned friends there that actually $5.2 billion is nothing if it means a future for this country. It's literally nothing. I've seen no money being used elsewhere. I am bothered by the dropout rate, which is alarmingly high, especially when you compare it to the students that have succeeded, the students that have graduated, and you see that the students that have actually dropped out without completing their studies, it's much more than any one of the three types of students. And I'm asking the question, is it for financial reasons only? And I mean, I have no doubt that a lot of it is that. But I also want students to come to the party and own up also to saying, why is this dropout? Or is it the student's perspective only? Or what lies behind this dropout? Because, again, I am so mindful of NSFAS following up on the students justifiably and correctly so, and following up and using money to follow up to no end and the students probably are not traceable, they're not working, they can't pay back, and we still have to have money to follow them and so on, and all of this thing is reproducing itself. So I really don't know. I think Member James has spoken about leveraging funding from elsewhere other than government itself as one of the options, I would imagine. The minister, when he was presenting at VET sometime last year, had a notion. I just wanted to test whether there's still a sentiment around the student bank. I think I heard you mention something around that. Is that an option on the horizon or something like that? Again, this whole issue of UCT being 56,000 and Walter Sisulu being 25, it lends itself into an impression that actually UCT provides better quality education than Walter Sisulu, and therefore, again, there's a reproductive cycle for me. So those are just some of the things I would have wanted to say. Only because the minister is here, I would want to say, the minister keeps on talking about humanities or social science students being more and so on. And I wish you could say something about this and say these are the how many humanities we want, rather than you defending yourself against the science students that we need. The minister is always apologetic about the many social science students. We really need them. We really do. And that's the comment, minister. Again, with the University of Venda, University of Mpumalanga in Northern Cape, I would imagine that the ministry is applying its mind, and I'm sure it is, because, again, we are going to be getting into another cycle of this NSFAS and all of that. And I'm also saying that, for me, it's not a question of just universities for the sake of universities. It's a question of what those universities will be doing, who they will be servicing, and what needs they will be servicing. And that, for me, would be very important. I'll pause there, Chair. Thanks.
Member Kubai Lefetso.
Thanks, Chair. Let me echo the sentiments of my colleagues by welcoming this presentation today. And also reflecting that Minister would appreciate as the committee that we are also we feel important and treated as such, that we do not hear things first on the media and later get engaged as the committee, because as such, it's as if you're reducing our responsibility and our constitutional right as members of Parliament. And therefore would appeal that in part of your processes, when you put or you are to do something, the committee is reflected as well in part of the review. The fact that even the review committee never interviewed the members of this committee to understand their input is another issue. Safe to say, Chair, that from where I'm sitting, when I look at this presentation and just scribbling through the report, not having much time to engage the entire detailed report, and having looked at the strat plan of NSFAS, to me it simply says that NSFAS needs to go back to the drawing board and produce a new strat plan based on what the minister has presented today. So what we have in front of us is something else compared to what the minister is proposing, especially on the immediate things that need to happen. My understanding is that they need to go into the plan so that we can evaluate. Otherwise, we would end up with having too many things to evaluate, which are everywhere. Our primary focus and responsibility as the committee is to evaluate their organization based on their strat plan, and it has to talk to what the minister has said today. Acknowledging that the report was released yesterday through you, Chair, I'm hoping that we'll find a way of either requesting NSFAS to produce something immediately, inputting on what the minister said and present it to the committee, as what would become a tool that will analyze and evaluate them based on, not the current document that is sitting in front of us. That's my first input. Secondly, is to appreciate that most of the things that are reflected here, it's what has been there, unfortunately, it took so long. Happen. I mean, there are many young people who today are blacklisted and all that, who can't even find jobs after completing degrees because of owing. some of these things is what is there, and appreciating that there is work that is being done, and would obviously as a committee monitor that and reflect. Safe to say, Honourable Member James, my organization believes in free education as much as yours doesn't, and I think it's an issue of semantics, how we define free education, and from where you are sitting and from where I'm sitting. And I wouldn't want to get into that issue now. But the issue, again, it goes, Minister, I remember I asked even the same question to say, I think what is raised by the students to say, we've got to be careful when we start providing this NSS. We've seen it in the past, whereby institutions start raising the fund, the cost going up. We've seen it even more above the inflation rate. And therefore, that, I remember when you responded in my question, Minister, you were saying that you are looking into the matter, and I'm hoping that you are, indeed, and would get a reflection in terms of the university fees. That you can't have a situation whereby fees are used to block access to education, because that's what it does. Hence, you'd find a number of students that they're dropping out. You might enter the university at the first year level, able to afford the institution fees, and then at the second, as you go, the fees are going higher. And as a member of, or a learner or a student, eventually you can't afford even to complete your degree. We've got to try and make sure that through NSFAS and other means that we provide, we ensure that students who enter universities are able to complete their studies through the support that we do. As I said, Minister, that I have not been able to look at the document fully, but I hope one of the things that we'll be able to respond to is the socio-economic needs of the students, not only fees, but the ability of the student when they enter tertiary, the support in terms of their books, the support in terms of their accommodation, the support in terms of their transport costs. Because if a student gets NSFAS, they pay their student tuition fees, and that student can afford to travel, let's say staying closer to the institution, but there's no money to travel between home and that's another issue. That's, those socio-economic issues still affect the student, the level of performance, the ability to concentrate and be able to graduate eventually. Those are some of the things that we've got to grapple with, and hopefully as part of this process we'll be able to look at. And I'm of the view that NSFAS can continue to offer limited amount of support to students, but we must all actually move to the level of 100% support for students. And I saw in terms of the college sector, you are moving for that in terms of the review, and hoping that will translate as well even for the higher the universities. Thanks, Chair.
Two people. Afnod Lefecho Magazi.
Thank you, Chair. Let me also take the opportunity to thank the presentation from the Honourable Minister, but at the same time say that my preference is that in future take us along before you go public, Mr. Minister, as a committee. You see, this report is long overdue. You see, you are telling us that the students have been blacklisted, and this goes a long way, because we're talking about 316,000 people who dropped out from the system of education. How do they pay their loans? And even if later in their life, most of them, they graduate and they don't find work, so they will remain blacklisted. Even if they find work, they cannot buy anything, they cannot build houses because they are blacklisted. So, and as far as I would love to say that this is urgent as yesterday. When is the minister taking his recommendation to the cabinet? And when can we expect the result of this your recommendation? Because they are very, very long overdue. I can talk a lot of things here, Minister, but I think the document says everything. Thanks so much.
The turnaround time is August of this year. This is what I've picked up earlier, for implementation of some of the aspects beginning January. Can we get the last person? Mr. Magazi.
Thanks. Thanks, Chair. And I would also like to appreciate and congratulate this report from the minister's office. But, Chair, there are few issues that I want to raise, but some of those issues, I think Honorable Kubai covered me and Honorable Vukos. But, Chair, I just want to ask, I think it's a general question, but relevant to, you know, to this. I just want to ask, you know, the minister, in one of the slides, he mentioned that as the committee, at some point, we will have to have held hearings. On this issue. But, Chair, I'll be honest. Yes, we will have those hearings. But as I'm sitting here, I am thinking, does the minister really believe in this committee, or does he see this committee playing a big role in this issue of finding solutions to solve, you know, the NSFAS issue? Do we have any role, you know, as this parliament? And I think Honorable Kubai, because I want also to bite on that point and actually emphasize on it, that members of the task team were appointed, but as this committee, I think we did not have a say, you know, on that, more especially when it comes to the terms of reference for their investigation, because I would like to see sometimes, whereas members of you know, of this portfolio committee, because we are coming from different political parties and we have our constituencies and we are on the ground. So I think it was going to be better, you know, for us also as this portfolio committee to contribute to the terms of reference. So we sort of guide. Yes, Chair, I am tempted to talk about, you know, the board. But I think let's park that as this committee, because I'm also concerned about the appointment of the board, because as Parliament, I think there are better processes, you know, to appoint a board where the Parliament itself, not the executive, the Parliament itself, it appoints those boards. And
I haven't gone through, I must be honest, the Education Act in terms of appointing, you know, the parastatal board, what it says. I know in other, you know, for instance, in communication with a clear ECA, it spells out one of the chapters how do we appoint the board. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you. I think, members, I noted one hand or so, but I'm not going to take it. What I would want to, we've been here since 9:30. I also think that the minister's opening statement indicated that in terms of the content issues and the details, that you have an approach in dealing with that in this meeting. There's obviously other issues that also came to reflection. They'll also find ways of dealing with that. But, Minister, I really would want to close soon this meeting, not this part of it, just in terms of our pleasures around the NSFAS, but also a decision to be taken around Honourable Member Kubai's suggestion. But that we can only really do if we've got reflection on the report. So to possibly get a few responses, and then I'll just close this chapter appropriately. I think what we are hearing, though, is that there is full support for the essential issues spelled out in the review process, that there is tactical questions, there's content issues, there is possibly from different perspectives, the way we appreciate either the words, the semantics, but even, for example, some stance from where we'd come from politically, that there was a concern raised by members in the context of just the flight in the public domain and the process towards the committee. But on the content and the substantial issues relating to the actual report, that I am picking up that the challenge of how do we actually move between now and August and also create a platform as the executive are reflecting on actions to be taken, how do we create a platform for engagement and making sure that input is taking place. I think one of those platforms today is, as the student has raised it with the portfolio committee, some journalists, I must admit, to the student has asked me, did the students try and preempt the outcome of the review process? And I think they possibly also ask you that question. Was it a tactical thing or was it a substantial issue? That's tongue-in-cheek. That's what was raised. I'm not asking the president of SASCA to respond on that. But
Minister, victory.
Possibly over to you. But also, Minister, thank you. You did indicate in that other life, the Credit Act and the issues related. I think that was quite a revolutionary piece of legislation in the South African domain. I think what we are now seeing is the implications, in a sense, a retrofitting exercise, not necessarily in this space only, but obviously wherever we will go through society, picking up that act and the implications on that act of society. So, Richard.
Thanks, Chairperson. And thanks to all the comments and issues that have been raised. I'm just going to really pick up on a few because I think largely it's comments that members were raising, which of course we will take into account as we take this process forward. I think that the Higher Education Summit provides a very important platform to do some of the things or to move closer to some of the things that SASCA, for instance, was talking about, and to a certain extent, SAUS. I think the issue of state-supported or free education by Honourable Member James, perhaps it's semantics, but it is free for the student, and that's why that language has been used when talking about free education, because it is indeed free for the student. So it's a language that has evolved to the main characterize that. That is why we're using that language. Now, this links to another point that has been raised by a couple of members here on the issue of fees. In reviewing the funding formula, it's inevitable that we will actually have to look also into the issue of fees. Because whilst one must allow a certain measure of flexibility because you might have programs of a particular type and demand, but also we can't just be disinterested as government in the issue of the rise of fees. It's something that we have to look into as part of actually looking at the funding formula, the review as a whole. I think this issue of the relationship between the minister and the portfolio committee, it's a tricky one, which we will have to navigate as we move forward. Because, yes, where feasible, it should be ideal to actually use the portfolio committee. We don't have a problem with that. But it may not be always feasible to do that, not because one doesn't take the portfolio committee seriously. There might be other considerations, of course, which might also not be in your interest as an oversight committee at the same time, so that we don't play the roles at the same time. But the issue of taking the portfolio committee seriously, there is no question about that. Portfolio committee is very important, and we will continue to treat it in that way. In some other instances, for instance, where perhaps we need to share with the committee, depending on the situation, sometimes we touch the chair and say, "Chair, I would just like, because of the sensitivities of these things, just be aware of this and that." So it's something that we've got to negotiate as we move on. But I don't think that the fact that we held a press conference yesterday to release this thing is a sign that we are not taking the portfolio committee seriously. Honorable Vuoza, just very quickly, dropout is not only due to financial reasons only, although financial reasons are a significant factor. For instance, I have been engaging with the student movement, something that I want to continue to do, to actually look into this question of dropouts and throughputs. They are not the only constituents that is important for that, but it's also very critical as part of trying to look comprehensively at the problems that are leading to low participation rates, dropout rates, and all that. The idea of a student bank, the committee didn't pursue this matter. It looks like what they looked into was to say, at least if you can be able to target the kids of public servants, you would go some way in addressing the middle. But it's a matter that we will have to pursue on our side in terms of those who fall outside the net but still cannot be able to afford. What should we do about that? We're not writing off the issue of the a student bank. I don't want to be misunderstood. I was just making an example. I'm a social scientist. I agree that we do need social sciences in this country. All what I was trying to illustrate is, how do we put students in line with our overall development needs so that you don't have a lopsided situation where at UCT at the moment you only have possibly 3 black South African students who are in the actuarial program. And yet we have thousands and thousands in sociology, which is my subject. That's the issue. If we are looking at skills, social science skills are very vital. For me personally, ideally, Chair, without going overboard, no student should go through university without some exposure to social science. just like we want to mainstream math and science at school, we should actually mainstream math and science at colleges and universities. Ideally, I'm sure Honorable James will also agree with me on this. But we do need to think skills. Where do we want to do this? Northern Cape and Mpumalanga, I will be talking more about this. I understand some members of the committee are upset. You can't commit money to a university in Northern Cape and Mpumalanga without first doing a proper feasibility study. Where do you put that money into what? Frankly. And we'll be talking details in the budget vote about what steps we are taking already this year. For instance, there are campuses that are in Mpumalanga, there are campuses that are in the Northern Cape. What do we do with those? Are they possibly the first step? You simply take your TU2 campus and whatever in Mpumalanga and then say, you are now University of Mpumalanga, that's your start. All that I'm saying is that we have to look into all those things. You have to know, and even to say, if we start now, how much is it going to cost? And where would we be within the next 3 to 5 years, for instance? What's the plan and all that? So we'll be giving a bit more details in the budget vote next week about what we intend doing. In this, just the last couple of points, you know, that also just maybe to. I think that the issue raised by Honorable Kupai, it is yes very important that your strategic plan must reflect things that you want to do. But a strategic plan is not a detailed implementation plan. And always new things will arise, which may not even be in your strat plan. For example, arising out of this report, when we respond in August, we're talking next year's strategic plan in terms of reflection. But our current strategic plan does reflect that we will have to be dealing with recommendations of NSFAS, for instance. It does say that, but we couldn't have gone given more detail than that. We are going to be reviewing the CETA landscape. We can't have the details in the plan other than to say that is what we are going to be doing. The exact form that it takes may be different than we may be conceptualizing it now, or maybe even the manner that it might be anticipated in the strategic plan. You know, Chairperson and honorable members and comrades, we are not, I don't want now as if I'm anticipating what we are going to be doing, but the tension that was facing the review committee, which is going to continue to face all of us as a country, do you give more for less or less for more? It's not going to go away. It's not going to go away. Even if you can shift your qualifications, your means test, let's say to 150,000 or 180,000, it will always arise. Are you going to give more for less students, more money for less students, full, or a little bit for more? It's an issue. Of course, we'll have to make choices and take decisions. We have to make recommendations to cabinet, for instance, once we are through with this process. But it's an issue that we should not just take simply. We must approach it in the manner that it needs to be approached. Chairperson, I think that that's just about it in terms of the issues that. Oh yeah, let me just end by saying The report tends to talk more about universities rather than colleges. It's not a reflection of the fact that we aren't prioritizing colleges. But the issues have tended to be more complex when it comes to issues relating to university funding than the colleges. That is why I think that the report tends to be biased towards that. We are quite conscious of the fact that we are actually looking at both universities and colleges. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Minister. I'm not going to allow Mema Khadebe, but let me use that example. Minister, I think the issues that you've raised, especially around the NSFIS report, I think those are the issues that we completely will have to support. I think it gives a new space in terms of implementation. However, the message that I think you received, that some members in this committee around the university in the Northern Cape and the university in Mpumalanga, that issue that you've raised, that